Do aliens exist and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 2 of the Warped Reality Podcast. I'm your host, Ghost Joe. I have a great show planned for you guys today. I have some cool news, some cool features, some cool segments, and an awesome interview with Mr. Steve Neal. So, because of the awesome special guests that I have on this show today, I wanted to make this whole show all about aliens and UFOs. So please stay tuned to that if you really like it. And if you do like this kind of format and you want me to do like a full episode on a certain topic, just let me know and we might make that happen. Just give me a call at 845-379-1331 or email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. So before we get into some articles that I wanted to share with you guys, some recent articles concerning UFOs and aliens, I wanted to give you my stance on this subject a little bit. So, just like a lot of people, I definitely believe that there is something out there. I mean, it would be quite naive to think that we're the only living beings, intelligent living beings, in the entire universe. I do believe that people do see aliens, and that I actually do believe that they are among us. Have I ever seen any UFOs or aliens? No, I have not. But my interview later on in the show, Mr. Steve Neal, will tell you all about his experiences. And I am sure, I am positively sure that if you are not a believer, he will absolutely make a believer out of you. Now, can a lot of things be explained away? I'm sure a lot of things can be explained away. But sometimes you just have to think outside the box a little bit where, hey, we don't know everything that's going on in this universe. You know, the universe is gigantic. We don't even know what's on the bottom of our ocean floors, you know, throughout the entire thing. We don't know a lot of things. So who's to say that there aren't aliens among us? There are scientists that may have some explanations, but at the same time, you have scientists saying, yeah, well, it's not aliens, but it's I don't know what it is. So if you don't know, how could you say what it's not? So now, guys, I'm going to read to you the top 10 states with the most UFO sightings from Stacker.com. Now, remember, guys, these are reported UFO sightings. They're not the exact numbers, of course. And, of course, there are many people that might have seen things that they never reported as well. So, but it's an interesting list. And here we go. So number 10 is North Carolina with 2,629 UFO sightings. Number 9 is Illinois with 2,758 sightings. Number 8 is Ohio with 3,012 sightings. Number 7 is Arizona with 3,188 sightings. 6 is Pennsylvania, 3,517 sightings. 5 is New York, 3,830 sightings. I've never seen anything, guys. You know I'm from New York. I've never seen anything. I would love to, though. I think it's very interesting. Number 4 is Texas with 3,848 sightings. Number 3 is Washington State, 4,351 sightings. Number 2 is Florida, 5,826 sightings. And number 1, this is a big jump too. Number 1 is California with 10,333 UFO sightings. There's got to be something going on, guys. Why is that number so high? In 2020, there were a reported 7,200 plus UFO sightings in the US. That's up by 1,000 sightings from the previous year. In Canada, Ontario, Quebec, and BC led the country for the most UFO sightings, according to ufology research reports. The Maritime provinces saw a big jump in sightings from 30 in 2019 to 151 in 2020. Throughout the rest of the world, there were 105 sightings in Ireland in 2020, 71 in France, and 70 in Spain. Which begs the question, why are there so many more sightings in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world? Makes you kind of think, right? So right now we're going to debut a new segment of the show called April's Creepy Corner, hosted by April Alder. So take it away, April.
Hello, spooky friends. This is April's Creepy Corner. And in this episode, we are talking all about extraterrestrials. According to most major sources, there are 9 defined types of extraterrestrial beings. Possibly the most well-known are the Greys. The gray-skinned humanoids are usually 3 to 4 feet tall, hairless with large black heads, black almond-shaped eyes, slits for nostrils and a mouth, no ears, and 3 to 4 fingers. I don't know about you, but I would not want to wake up to that in my bedroom. Number 2, next are the Nordic aliens. These humanoids have typical Nordic features like blonde hair and blue eyes and are usually quite tall. It is said that they are from ancient Earth but present themselves as ETs. Number 3, the reptilians and reptiloids are tall, scaly humanoids dating back to ancient Egypt. Number 4, rods, aka skyfish, are elongated visual artifacts appearing in photos and video recordings, sometimes claimed to be extraterrestrial beings, although something that is just the blur on the photo caused by lights or insects. Number 5, moving on to the Flatwoods monster, which is a tall humanoid with a spade-shaped head. And it sounds like my ex-boyfriend. Which brings us to number 6, the Hopkinsville goblin, small greenish-silver humanoids. Number 7, little green men. These are mostly a cultural reference, as nothing has ever been reported that would fit this description. Number 8, results of a secret genetic engineering. Some speculate that extraterrestrials are escaped creatures that are a result of secret government corporate genetic experiments and hybridization projects, while others explain these as humans with heightened powers. And last but not least, number 9, the cryptozoological animals and cryptobotanical plants. While some people believe in encounters with creatures like the Jersey Devil and Mothman, others believe that they are actually extraterrestrial beings in nature. It's an interesting theory. What do you think? Well, that's the end of my list, and I hope you have learned something you can impress your friends with. This has been April's Creepy Corner. Stay spooky.
Thank you very much, April, for that information. It was very interesting and equally as terrifying. If you guys like that segment, please email me. Let me know at ghostjoeny@gmail.com, or you can call me at 845-379-1331 and leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or on the website warpedrealitypodcast.com. So Steve Neal is a special effects makeup artist, filmmaker, puppeteer, model maker, and visual effects artist in film and television industry with a career spanning over 35 years. Steve created, wrote, and produced The Daytime Ended in 1978. He's worked on Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters, Fright Night, Laser Blast in 1978, Crater Lake Monster in 1977, and many other sci-fi and horror films. He is the creator of But Something Is There, which was produced by himself, Paul Gentry, Whitley Strieber, and Mary Cacciapalia. And he just wrapped his follow-up to that movie called The Dreamtime. Please check out the show notes for his websites so you can check out all of his endeavors, his lengthy portfolio, and his movies, which are free to watch, by the way. By the way, I honestly had to stop myself from asking any more questions because he's such an interesting and down-to-earth guy. I had a great time talking to Steve, and I hope we could do it again. So without further ado, here's the recorded interview I had with Mr. Steve Neal.
That's letting me know I'm being recorded. So I won't tell the story about what happened when I was underground in a top secret facility and I was told never to talk about it.
Right. Yeah. Don't talk. So,
So, Steve, how did you get involved in the film industry? When did you start?
Well, I mean, I always liked movies, and particularly I liked Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock, films about space travel, sci-fi and horror, always, you know, since I can remember. But by the time I got into high school, of course, Star Trek came on the scene, and I really liked Gene Roddenberry's vision for us in the future. And it wasn't too long after that that I saw 2001: A Space Odyssey. And simply because a friend of mine in high school said, I just saw a film, and we are both only 16. He said that it's so much better than Star Trek. And it's like, well, you really can't compare them. It's apples and oranges. But he did. He said, I said, better than Star Trek? He says, no, you don't understand. You need to go see this film. Well, I didn't have a car then, so I had to get on the Greyhound bus because I lived in Pacifica, going to San Francisco. I went to the Golden Gate Cinerama and went to see this film. And I had no idea what I was in for. And I walked in, and it was this amazing theater with this wraparound kind of screen. And it was playing this real creepy music, which I later found out was Gregory Ligeti. And it was music that was being used in the film. And it, just the whole mood of the thing, I'm sitting there and it gets dark and the music's still playing and then it stops. And then there's this low hum from Also Sprach Zarathustra. It's hard one to say. Again, I didn't know what that symphony was at the time. As much as I was into classical music, I missed that one somehow. And I see the MGM lion on the curtains. The curtains start to part. The next thing you see is some stars at the top of the screen and a shadow moving, which I later figured out, you know, that's the moon. And then there was the earth and the sun's riding over it. And this incredible music and credit scene. And I was gone right away. I mean, I was immediately hooked. The film, I won't go through all the details, but the film flabbergasted me. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. I went home obsessed with the film, obsessed with Stanley Kubrick, and started getting into filmmaking. And I started making my own films in school. After I got out of high school, I saw an article in the newspaper, and it was about George Lucas, and he was making a movie called THX 1138, which I think is his best film he ever made, because it's a real film. And that he was at this place called the American Zoetrope, and there was this guy there, Francis Ford Coppola. And in the article, in the Chronicle, they talked about they wanted to help young filmmakers, and they were there for them. So, you know, I got their telephone number. I called up and I said, hey, I'm a young filmmaker. I've made these films and stuff. They invited me down. I met Lucas and Coppola, and I became friends with Coppola, and I worked there kind of like an apprentice, and I did things for them, intern, and they let me work with their equipment and make my own films there. So that's how I got started.
That's some story. That's amazing.
That was a short version.
Hey, that's
I won't tell you about all the wild parties in Marin County with those guys. It was a really fun time, and all the great Fillmore concerts we went to, and the fun things we did. So
you might get some hate. You might get some hate mail that you said that his best movie was that instead of Star Wars. Though I don't know.
Well, of course I will, and I've got it before, because what people don't understand is that they're for me. There's filmmaking where you're doing a real piece of art on film, which is what 2001 is, and so many other really great movies. And then there's movies, which are fun. They're entertaining. I won't deny that. But they're kind of like product, you know, and it's like, well, I like this Chef Boyardee pretty good. And this was, you know, they're really just formula. You can almost predict the outcome every time you see one. You know, like Independence Day, it's a perfect example of that. And I enjoyed that film. I'm not putting the film. I enjoyed the Godzilla movie they made, the first one, the first newer one. So I'm not. I like that kind of pulp entertainment. But really, that to me is what Lucas was doing. And I knew Lucas well enough to know that he was a Kubrick type filmmaker. And it's obvious if you watch THX 1138 that he's quite the visionary, and did things with film that were not by the book. You don't stick to formula. You don't in the movie making world in Hollywood, there's rules you follow. You don't depart from them, otherwise you're a weirdo and we'll never give you an Academy Award, which is an honor not to get one, because the greatest movies ever made never got an Academy Award. 2001 is one of them. Citizen Kane is another. And that was a film, you know, so, and Orson Welles was another filmmaking artist genius. So.
What titles have you held in the film industry?
Prosthetic makeup artist, creature maker, a great deal. Because that, you know, they always told me when I came to Hollywood, you need to get a real job. Because, you know, you need to go wait tables and do all this stuff. That's what they tell actors to do and would-be filmmakers and everyone. So I got a job making monsters for movies. It was pretty steady and it paid a hell of a lot of money. It got me into the Screen Actors Guild, which allowed me to do acting in my own creatures and in TV commercials, which afforded me a lot of residual money and from residuals and stuff. So that was pretty good. I also did miniature work on occasion, prop work on an occasion. I worked in visual effects, you know, optical printing, stop motion animation, but not as much as I did the makeup effects stuff, but also wrote and produced a motion picture called The Day Time Ended. I always hated the title because the original script I wrote was titled Vortex. And of course, Irwin Yablons said, we can't use that title because no one will understand it. You don't know what a vortex is? He says, I don't. So why would they? So it became, yeah, I know. And it just went on from there. I was young. I was in my 20s. I wrote this really nice script, which I still have. And they made the films, which is typical of Hollywood. They take something that I was trying to do a really artistic film and make something about the paranormal, and they kind of made it into pulp, you know. But still, the film was really well liked. And to this day, it's been re-released on Blu-ray. I get asked about it all the time. And we had cutting edge special effects in it that no one had ever done before. So I've been a filmmaker, too. And I've been a director and I've been a producer and I've been a writer. And so I've worn many, many hats.
And what would you say was the first, like, most notable film that you worked on?
Star Trek, the motion picture. Wow. I was fortunate enough that when I was working on these B pictures, Rick Baker initially hooked me up with a couple of different producers, Larry Cohen, Charlie Band. We were friends and we lived close by, and there was jobs he couldn't do anymore because he was getting bigger and bigger all the time. And so I got my start that way, thanks to him. But then somehow, some way, I ran into Fred Phillips, and Fred Phillips is famous for Star Trek and The Outer Limits, the original Outer Limits TV series. And Fred was a wonderful, very charismatic guy. And I forget how it went exactly, but I was working for Bob Schiffer, and then who was the head of Disney Make Department at Disney. And then one day I got a call from Bob. He says, I've been asked to do a Shaggy Dog again, because he did the original Shaggy Dog. He says, I can't do it. I'm under contract with Disney. I want you to do this job. And it was a TV show called McDuff with the Shaggy Dog. Now, I was in the makeup union, but in those days you had to take a test. You had to have so many days and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't qualified yet on the list to be able to work the show. I could do the prosthetics and all that, design the makeup. So I knew Fred. So I got Fred the job. Fred returned that job one day by calling me up, and I thought he was joking with me. He said, hey, Steve, you want to work on Star Trek? I said, what? I started laughing at him. I said, Star Trek ended years ago. He said, no, we're doing a movie. Really? On the level? He said, yeah. And I need you to come down and do Leonard Nimoy's ears for me because my eyes aren't what they used to be. You're kidding, right? He said, no.
Wow.
You start tomorrow. I'll leave you a pass at the Gower Gate, and in you go. And it went from there. And I got to, you know, I already knew Gene Roddenberry pretty well, but, you know, Gene was all in favor of me being there. And Robert Wise, I'd never met before. And that was, you know, you're talking gods here, you know, you know, Gene Roddenberry and Robert Wise from The Day the Earth Stood Still and Andromeda Strain and all these great movies. And it was just the time of my life. And whenever I get asked, what's the favorite thing you ever have done? everyone's always expecting me to say, you know, laser blast, not laser blast. Well, that too, laser blast, Ghostbusters, but it's always Star Trek because I love Star Trek. And it was so great to do Nimoy's ears and get to know the whole crew, all those actors, and work with them and be on the sets and stuff. It was just, it was just such a rush.
That's so iconic too. The biggest thing that people know about Spock, you know, is the ears.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, years later, of course, not that long ago, Adam Nimoy, his son, decided to do a documentary called For the Love of Spock. And I wanted to help him raise money for it. So since I had Leonard Nimoy's original ear molds, which are still in my possession, I said, I can make up a bunch of these ears from your dad's mold and we can use those as perks. So he came up to the studio and visited, and that was really neat, and shot some footage of me working on the ears and stuff. So I got to know his son a bit, and his son gave me a tunic from the original TV show. It was a replica that he had made, and because all the originals are long gone or rotted away or in some collection somewhere. And he also gave me an autographed picture of his dad, because he found out that I would not ask anyone on the set for an autograph when I was working on Star Trek. And I had worked on Star Trek more than once. So he sent me this really nice picture of his dad signed. So that was really a nice, that ended the Star Trek cycle for me, because I worked on Star Trek VI, and I also worked on the first episode of The Next Generation. So I was fortunate to be able to work on those things. So.
Here's a good segue right here. So speaking of space, Steve, can you tell us the first time you remember either, you know, your first experience with seeing a UFO or?
Yeah, well, there's a first experience. I have two of them, and I don't know, because I was very young, which one came first, but I'm pretty sure the one that came first is when I was in Marin County, where I was staying in a town called Santa Venetia. It was very underdeveloped. It was the countryside. The stars were thick at night with the Milky Way, and my grandfather and I used to go out for walks. And we saw a lot of unusual things during those walks. And one night, we saw this, we went out, I think he had the binoculars. We went out to see, I believe Sputnik was one of the satellites. And we thought we found it, but then there was this red orange ball thing that was coming towards us. And it looked like it was on fire. I mean, not like heavy duty flames. Well, you saw the film, it looked just like that. It had this sort of rippling effect on it, like heat. And it came and just hovered right over us, and it was amazing. And then it turned and went down the road, shot up into the sky. And my grandfather had lots of experiences with ghosts, and he claimed to have heard the Banshee and had seen little people. He never called them leprechauns, and he was from Ireland. And my grandmother used to make fun of him all the time and just said that, you know, he was crazy. Wow. And all this stuff, which really bothered me, because I knew he's being on the level. He's being honest with me. That comes out in the film. And then it wasn't too long after that that I remember waking up middle of the night, and there was this absence of sound. I'd never heard anything like it in my whole life. To that point, I was maybe 6-7 years old, I guess, somewhere in there. And I mean, you couldn't hear anything. And I lived in San Francisco on 47th Avenue. I was not that far from Playland and all that stuff. And you know, I mean, even at 3 a.m, there were cars going up and down Gary Street and all that stuff. So there should have been something. It was absolutely like a vacuum. And that's what woke me up, was the vacuum, the lack of sound. So I kind of looked around the room, and then these little beams of light came through the window, and they started shining all around inside my room. Well, that really got my curiosity. And that was late 50s. We didn't have helicopters flying over homes in those days and shining spotlights looking for criminals, so it wasn't that. Plus, it was dead silent. So I was a little unnerved by it, so I kind of slithered off the bed and tried to creep along the edge of the wall and get to the windowsill and look out to see where the lights were coming from. And the minute I did that, I saw the lights, and they immediately acted like they saw me. And I'm thinking, well, there's somebody up there. They could see me because the lights reacted to me. Then I got a little scared. So I went to hide under my desk and figuring that, you know, the lights wouldn't find me there and hopefully this would all go away because I was getting kind of unnerved by the whole thing. And then the lights came in the room. And so, you know, and I got this sense that there was something there and there was some kind of shape, humanoid shape, figure, shadow. And then the next thing I knew, it was morning. And I had got on, in the film, it shows me sleeping on a rug in front of my parents' bed, but I had been getting on their bed at night because this has been, this was happening over and over again. And they did not want me doing that. And so I, later on, I took to sleeping on the carpet. You know, I just sort of, I didn't tell them about it. You know, I talked about I'm having nightmares and I'm scared. And I never talked about it. I was smart enough to know even then, if I was to say what I had seen and what had happened, that I wouldn't be believed because of my grandfather. Because he wasn't believed. And so here is some of the same stuff happening to me. And I knew from him, keep your mouth shut. So
for lack of a better term for the, for these beings, well, I mean, I know you don't like the term alien, but what would you call these beings?
I really don't know. I just, well, you know, Whitley calls them the visitors and I've sort of adopted that for lack of a better term, because, you know, lots of people who are involved with the iconic term alien abduction, which I also don't really like, you know, claim they know who they are. And they claim they're Zeta Reticulans and they're grays and they come from Zeta Reticula. Well, they don't even know why they're saying that, most people, because if they knew anything about the history of the subject matter, then they know about Barney and Betty Hill, and they know about Betty Hill and the famous map that she was shown and then drew under hypnosis that years later they made a 3D model of and found the exact star pattern matching it that was Zeta Reticula. And so, you know, it was thought that maybe the people that abducted them were from Zeta Reticula and they kind of had the look of grays and they just kind of went that way. So, but I just call them the visitors. I really don't know what I'm dealing with. I don't. I know I get a sense of what they're all about after all these years. And I'm not really threatened by any of it anymore. I've just sort of incorporated it into my life and it's just the way it is. And the worst thing I ever did was in the 90s go public about it. So it just practically ruined my career and relationships and family and everything else because they think you're nuts. The public has been so well trained and you're familiar with this because you know that that ghosts, for lack of a better term, spirits, whatever, they exist. Plenty of people have seen them. There's plenty of evidence. Sure. It's, and the two phenomena are actually related. So right. It's a real hard one, you know, to have in your life because people, you know, you can talk about, well, I was a drug addict and now I'm clean and all, they'll hug you and tell you how wonderful you are and stuff. And you could say that, you know, you're a Jesus freak, you know, and you're born again and all that. That's all fine too. And, but you say that I've had interactions with some unknown intelligence that's non-human, they start to leave the room. In fact, when they come into your show, an alt space, they come in, I watch them. They stand there for a few minutes and go, this is bullshit. And then they leave, you know, because they're scared. They're scared to death. You know, it's like, what if we're right?
That's the funny thing, too, that I think is pretty funny. And you actually hit it on the head with my alt space show that I do. But even as far as like all these Facebook groups, right? So all these people belong to like these paranormal Facebook groups. And then when somebody posts a picture up, automatically, oh, it's fake. It's fake. It's listen, you're here.
Yeah.
So you just joined this group just to say that everything is fake. No, not sure that it's pretty easy nowadays to fake stuff like that, but not everybody is faking it. It's silly to think that everyone is trying because you don't even get 15 minutes of fame from it anyway.
No,
anymore.
No.
So it's not even like you're really even doing anything. What? So you could post up a fake picture and have people say, oh yeah, wow, wow, wow. And then that's all you're going to get. So you know, there's no reason to going around faking things like that.
Right. But they still are. And I mean, like recently, Whitley Strieber just sent me some video to look at and analyze about this English gentleman who found some hominid creature living in the woods that doesn't match anything that we know about. And his videos are so convincing to the public that he's got a huge following. He's making tons of money off this stuff. It took me 5 seconds to tell Whitley how he did it, because it was so obvious it was CG. You know, animals behave a certain way, especially primates. And that was the first tip off. But the other tip off was, is I told him, I said, all I have to do is lock off my camera, shoot 4K footage in the direction of foliage in a forest, and pick a spot where I want something to show up. Stick a green screen behind the branches and the foliage, shoot the footage, stop, remove the green screen, shoot some more footage without it. And then in three layers, I can put in a creature animated using motion capture and CGI animation in between those two layers and have it perfectly matched in quality to the camera and everything there. Then I can, in 4K, pull in a bit in Adobe Premiere in the editor and actually put handheld camera moves and stuff so it looks handheld. And then everyone talks about how, well, see, it's got to be real because it's handheld. And, you know, you can't track stuff that well. Oh, yes, you can. So it can be done. And I've sent videos all the time, and 99% of them I debunk. That, when I was doing that publicly, that was really upsetting the fanatics. They want to believe everything they see is real. And how can you do that? You of all people. It's like, because I'm being honest here. What about this one that I couldn't debunk? What about this one that's genuine? You know, and those are the ones that count. So
yeah, it's a shame though too, because you know, there's these people that are faking it and there's people that aren't, and it's giving these people, like I was saying, you know, somebody that really did take a certain picture of something and they post it up and now everybody thinks it's fake. When in fact they're like, no, I really, you know, nobody's gonna believe them. You know, everybody just constantly harps on them, no, it's fake, to the point where they end up leaving the group because they're so upset that people are doubting them like that. It's terrible.
In my case, if you know, when, and I see things quite often, and I do have the opportunity sometimes to get it on video, I don't even bother. With my background in visual effects and special effects and stuff, no one's going to believe
me.
I'm doomed no matter what I do. The only way it'll actually work is if I have someone there with me. And even then, you know, well, you got them to conspire. How much money did you get them to say that? You know, it's all gone. You know, it's just like,
right, of course. Yeah. Yep.
And then there's the other problem too. And that is that in a few cases that I've been involved in with really up close and personal close encounters with friends, after it happened, they didn't remember it. Days, week, two later, no memory of it whatsoever. So I just sort of gave up.
That's insane. That's incredible, though.
Yeah.
I mean, so actually going back to that, what do you remember as far as like your first encounter with, you know, the visitors? How was that first experience? How old were you? What exactly?
Yeah, I was 6-7 years old, and I don't. The only thing I remember is this voice saying, "We're not going to hurt you." That's very, very typical. And most of the experiences that I had in my youth, I have memories of what they were doing, and they were bringing me to some location that was very sterile, and you've heard about it. It's very sterile tables, and they do examinations and all that kind of stuff. Barney and Betty Hill said it first. And that stuff happened a lot. And there wasn't a lot of interaction intellectually between whatever this consciousness is and myself. That didn't happen until years later. And even now it's sparse. I mean, they're very short on words. They're very much for showing you possibilities, outcomes that they seem to want us to take very seriously in some way, somehow affect a change to avert these possible outcomes. And yet none of us have been successful to do it. And if you keep up with the news the way Mary does, I try to avoid it every morning. It's just all the environmental issues we have right now. They're like something out of a disaster movie. They're so apparent. They're so real. And watching the coastline raise, the high tides getting higher, it's really bothering, because when I was having these experiences, one of the constant things, and I still have them, are these experiences where everything's flooding, huge waves, tsunamis, and all this kind of stuff. And it's widespread throughout people in the community. Now, when I say the community, I'm talking about people I know. They don't talk publicly. They never wanted to. They never will. They'll never go in front of a camera. They don't even want their family to know. But they talk to me because of my film and because my association with Whitley. And so they'll write to me to kind of get the stuff off their chest. But they never wanted this in their life. They certainly didn't want media attention from it. And they too have been constantly shown and warned about disasters that are of our own making, and they're terribly apparent right now.
So what do they look like?
Well, okay, you see the typical bubble-headed, sort of pointed chin, big round, and the black eyes and slanted and everything. And the interesting thing about that is, until I started drawing those in the late 70s, early 80s, and it went public and it went into the UFO magazines and stuff, that image was not being readily used in our culture. Now it's everywhere. If I had been smart, I would have trademarked that. But I was honestly saying, this is what I saw, you know, and then other people were saying, that's what I saw. And then Whitley's book came out in 86 with the communion lady on the cover, which is very similar. And it just exploded from there. And now I can't walk down the street without seeing a gray alien in somebody's store window, you know, to grab your attention or bring you in to buy things, or antenna balls and that stuff. And for the most part, I was the guy behind that. Never planned it to be that way. But that iconic image of that shape that's got the pointed chin and the big wraparound eyes, that came from me. And I did see something like that. Now,
wow.
I saw it a lot. But that doesn't mean that that's real. I mean, it could be a projection. All I'm sure of is that it was tangible, physical. I could feel it. I could touch it. I could see it when I wasn't dreaming. You know, wake up in the middle of the night. Go out to the kitchen, 3 a.m. That's the usual witching hour with paranormal experiences I've found. I go out the kitchen, and sitting right there next to the refrigerator is one of those big wooden butcher block board, you know, you use to cut things on, four legs. And I look at it and I think, you know, my late wife, you know, why would she? The thing's heavy. Why would she put it in the middle of the floor next to the refrigerator? So I went to move it, and it moved. And then suddenly, no longer was it a butcher block. I saw two legs, and it moved, and I looked up kind of at it. It was shorter than me, but I was looking down and at what looked like sort of stumpy feet, as very straight legs that were kind of tan colored. And there was that face from Whitley's book cover, very similar, looking right at me, like, and it just shot right through the sink, the cupboards, into the living room. And I ran around into the living room to see if it would be in the living room. It was gone. I was wide awake. I wasn't dreaming. I hadn't been on drugs, nothing. I just wanted to get a glass of water. And with thinking back on it, I realized that our mind plays tricks on us. And a lot of times those tricks it's playing is to protect you. It's trying to survive. When it sees something it can't explain that just doesn't fit the reality we've been brought up in, then it'll give you a butcher block instead of a strange looking creature. And it wasn't until it moved that it kind of broke the, it was, I don't think it was projecting a table block, cutting block. I think my mind was saying, well, that's the closest thing I can grasp onto what's actually there. And that's what I saw. And it works both ways. So that gives the skeptics lots of room to batter us about this stuff, but I don't really let it bother me.
Right.
I know how it worked that night.
How many visitations would you say that you've had over the years?
God, I couldn't even count them.
Wow.
Because here's the other thing too about it is that once it gets your attention and you're consciously aware of it, it also it jumps into the dream time. Now, Western civilization doesn't know a lot about the dream time, but the Aborigine people sure do, and they know about the Wangina, and there's a lot of other native tribes that are quite familiar with the essence of the dream time, which is for them a very real place. We really don't know what dreams are. We actually don't. And there's not just one kind of dream. Because the dreams that I have when I have them are so vivid. They're no different than this reality I'm experiencing right now. They're not wacky. They're not crazy. They're not black and white. They're not soft focused. They're not blurry. They're linear. It's literally like I'm in another parallel life or reality, but sometimes it's also with the visitors. And all this stuff's connected. It's very easy to just pass it off as a dream, but I just know the difference. So they come quite often. It goes in cycles. And during the late 80s and 90s up to about 2001, it was out of control. And they were very physical. I'd wake up, lights would be in the room, people, shadows pulling on me, telling me to go back to sleep, don't worry about it. I remember waking up in underground facilities and seeing human beings there. And they had the human beings were there with these beings. But it wasn't always the black-eyed guys, too. It was sometimes it's these really tall, thin looking humans that could pass for real people in public. Sometimes they were dressed crudely, like they were from the 40s with hats. I'm sure you've heard about that. Not necessarily the men in black, but just they had this 40s kind of feel to them. So, which really made me jump when I watched the movie Hearts of Atlantis. If I don't know if you ever saw that film, but the Hearts of Atlantis, with drawing a blank, Anthony Hopkins. It's a great film, a real film. You should watch it. But so I, you know, it's been a myriad of different things I've seen and experienced, and again, it's always the same thing, you know. You're screwing the planet up. You're going to screw it up. It's going to get worse. But at the same time, they keep communicating that there's hope and not to give up and to have trust. These one-liners and two-liners that they drop on you. And I think that I was alone with that, except everyone else I talked to, they get the same stuff. So
they're not here to blow up the White House and do all the
make sushi out of us or eat us or right. I don't know what the deal is with the probes. You got to be able to laugh about the probe, but I don't know for sure, but it's my gut feeling that they very much have invested a lot in the human race and do care what happens to it.
Do you think they've been here for a long time? Do you think they've always been here? I mean,
that takes me back to 2001, A Space Odyssey. If you think about that film, I think now looking back on it, I know why the film spoke to me the way it did, because you had visitors, you know, 5 million years ago influencing the development, the evolution of the Australopithecus, so it could survive and become a much more advanced race of beings. Then they put another monolith on the moon, knowing that if we were clever enough, we'd get to the moon and we'd find it. And if we did find it, then it meant that we needed to be looked at again. And of course, you know, the film ends, you could, the Star Child, which is the hope for the future. It's a really simple story, but everybody overthought it. But and really, that really relates to this experience rather well. Wow. So, yeah, I do think that they've been around for a very, very long time.
And when you say that they communicated and said these one-liners, did they say it telepathically? Like, how did they, or did they actually move their mouths like they're talking to you?
No, you just hear it in your mind.
Wow.
The same way when you have a thought to yourself, you hear that thought. You hear your own voice. You hear it very clearly, and you hear, gee, that guy really thinks he's funny. I'll just smile. You know, it's very much like that. So I don't know that means that they can hear your thoughts, but I would imagine they probably can. And we know that there are human beings that are gifted enough on Earth that can hear people's thoughts, that can remote view, that can sense the presence of other spirit.
Sure.
That can read a person in 5 seconds. So it's not, you know, you have to remember that in our culture, we've been told we have no abilities, that all this stuff is bull, that there's no credibility to it. So just if you think you saw something, you didn't. If you think you heard someone think, or you had a psychic experience, you didn't. And so everyone discounts it, and they're literally turning off their ability.
Right.
The worst one of all is being told that when, thank you, Neil Tyson, that when you die, you're worm food. And be okay with it. That's a terrible thing to tell living beings when you don't know for sure if that's true or not. And he doesn't. And all the scientists who say that don't. They really don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I'm a science person, and I admire scientists, and I admire Neil Tyson a lot, but they say some really stupid things.
I guess they're so hung up on the whole logic thing, you know? And I remember, I don't think you were in the alt space room when I had this one guy there. There was this one guy that was just a complete... Now, like I always say, I don't mind skeptics. But there's something... There's one thing to be a skeptic, and then there's another thing to be... completely closed-minded, you know. If you see a ghost come right in front of you and say, "Hey, I'm a ghost," you're not going to say, "Oh, well, that wasn't a ghost," you know. Just all right. It's right in front of your face, you know. And there was this one guy in there that claimed he was a scientist. I doubt it, obviously, but he was saying, "Oh, well, this and that, and oh, I have to have proof and evidence." I said, "All right, that's great." I said, "But if you saw something yourself, how would you think?" He goes, "Oh, I wouldn't believe it. I would have to get somebody." I said, "Really?
Yes.
How? Are you serious though? Like, you can't trust your own mind. You don't know, you know, I understand sometimes your mind plays tricks on you. The mind is a crazy thing, you know, but at the same time, you got to know to trust yourself at certain times too. And it's just like, if you're that completely closed-minded, that's just crazy to me.
It's a very primitive way of thinking, I think. And I've been told that many times, that if you brought me an alien body, I just wouldn't believe it.
Right.
You know, so.
A little bit before, you had said that you had left the community for a little while, then you came. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Well, did you find that letter I wrote in 19, was it? It was 99, I think it was. There's a letter on the internet, Steve Neal Walks. If you type it in, you'll see. And well, you know, pretty much the things that you've brought up, Joe, is what made me leave, is that I was trying to be credible about my experience and not jump to conclusions about Zeta Reticulas and hybrid babies that were designed to take over and eradicate human beings or whatever it is they thought. I just didn't buy into that stuff because there was really, did I see babies in a tank? Yeah, I saw babies in a tank, and they didn't look, well, they looked human, but they were odd. Did I see them grown up. Some of them are ones that were more adult. Yes, they were very odd looking, and yet they, you could call them hybrids. I don't know that that's what they were for sure. And, you know, so I would try to say, well, let's keep an open mind about this because we really don't have any physical proof of this. We only have eyewitness testimony that that matches up, especially before the internet was big and people had never met each other before. They could draw the same thing, compare the same thing. But when you went outside of what I call Gaia, you've certainly heard of Gaia, and the whole David Wilcox and the Goody thing, when you went outside and dared to be practical about this or even treat it scientifically as best you could, then you were, you know, ostracized and you were, they got mad at you. And I just got tired of it and left. But the biggest reason that I left was because I was told to do it or else.
Wow.
Yeah, literally. I mean, well, my late wife, she was terrified of the whole thing. She thought I'd lost my mind. I did not have her support. She saw things that she couldn't explain and she tried to explain them away. She knew about the mail tampering. She knew about the phone taps. She knew about that black helicopter. She knew it because they followed her home and hovered over our driveway and terrified her when she's coming back to the grocery store. She knew about all this stuff, but she just said, she just figured I was making her crazy because I was crazy. And, I just keep the story short, but I don't want to use the word threat, but I was asked by the FBI and the CIA to stop being on talk shows and associating with Whitley and Dr. Roger Lehrer and all this kind of stuff, or it's not going to be nice for you. And that's when she says, you get out of this right now or I'm leaving you. So I was already pretty fed up with the community because of all the skullduggery going on and being at a MUFON meeting and having some guy walk up to me and show me his credentials from the CIA and telling me how I never was supposed to talk about that, that you're involved. And if you're involved, then you also are supposed to be secret about this stuff and you're breaking your agreement. It's like, what agreement? Evidently, some of us have an agreement that we made somewhere but don't remember doing it. To make a long story short, it just got to be too much. I mean, when my mail was, I wasn't getting my mail and people were sending me money and it was being returned to them. I said, that's it. I appeared on one last talk show with Jeff Rentz. And after the show, I mean, I talked about my leaving and everything. I got off the phone with him because it was done over the phone. And I went in and Julie said, so how'd it go? I said, it was great. You know, everything's fine. We're done. I'm done. I even took all the artwork and sculpture I did and I gave it away. I just completely got rid of it. We're sitting here talking. I hear this large rumble. And I go outside in the backyard and she can see me through the big sliding glass door. And I'm asking her to come out. She wouldn't do it. I said, please come out here. So she came out. It was a black Sikorsky helicopter hovering just like 200 feet over the house. It was near sunset and he shined a light at me and I waved at him and then I saluted him and he saluted back and she saw the whole thing and then he just turned like this and flew off and she just looked at me and I didn't say anything and that was the end of it. And you know, part of me was hoping that that would end the whole thing. But it didn't. It kept happening, and I just went back to keeping it to myself.
But why do you think, I mean, they got to know all they could ever know about humans by now. The fact that, you know, they do all these experiments and everything. Why do you think they keep coming back to the same people and doing all these, like, what's the explanation that you've come up with? Have you come up with any?
I've got all kinds of theories, but theories aren't explanations and theories aren't facts. So I always have a problem with theories because it's just, you know, just hunches, you know. I know one thing, that things that are paranormal seem to be attracted to me. And you know this from your own work, that there are people that it's this way. There's something we have, they sense. If I go into a building that's haunted, I can sense it right away. And sometimes the spirits will actually talk to me. I mean, I think I told you about that girl that was trapped in that house that was now a place of business where they sold books and stuff. And it was so oppressive. I had to get out of there, and I felt terrible because she was so sad. She didn't know she was dead, and she knew there was something that attracted her to me. She knew I knew. And so I often wonder if that isn't a big part of it, and that's not what attracted them in the first place. But I don't know why they continue on with it. Whitley and I talked about this a lot, and there were periods where it would go real quiet and we'd think, oh, it's over. It was all like a bad dream or something, you know. And then, you know, a year or two would go by and it would start up again. And it just, I don't know. What I keep getting lately is, like last night, there was this whole, I'm exhausted from it still. Usually if it's going to happen, it happens on a Sunday night. And I wake up the next day and I feel like I've drank a small bottle of tequila or something. I just feel hammered. And that whole night, all I could hear was have trust, have trust, have trust over and over again. And I was, and I remember a lot of things, and I didn't see the creatures with the black eyes or anything, but there were these very strange people, and they were putting me through all kinds of different scenarios and doing things that were really scary. It's like they were trying to get me to lose all my fear of things that human beings find frightening, to lose fear altogether. And the other thing they keep harping on me about is that I cannot, no matter how much you dislike people that are trying to harm you, you can't hate them. This was another thing that they said. If you hate at all for any reason, then you're no use to yourself or us. I don't know what that means. I mean, I understand what the philosophy is. I mean, yes, I agree with that philosophy. Mm-hmm. We have to stop hating each other. We have to stop having wars. We got a whole big universe out there full of stars and places to visit. Gene Roddenberry told us about that with Star Trek, and we should be doing that and unite, because there's really no races on the planet Earth. There's no black race or brown race. It's just all one race, the human race. And we should drop all this bull and get out there and explore the great unknown that's been waiting for us all this time. And yet people, they don't want to do that. Some do.
I know Elon Musk is a huge proponent in that. He really,
oh yeah,
his biggest things is he wants to get out there. He wants to get to Mars. He wants to do all this stuff. So
yeah, you know, well, it's important because, you know, the Earth is basically a nest we were born into, and we need to spread our wings and fly away from that nest, because birds that don't leave the nest die. And that's exactly what the human race is going to be, just extinct at the rate we're going. And even if we don't destroy our own environment, we're at risk from things outside the Earth, asteroid events. I mean, we don't even have enough people watching the skies to avert a possible asteroid if it were going to collide with us, because they just don't think it's important enough. They won't put money into it. You know, you've got the big party of no.
Right.
You know, and, you know, they talk about fixing the environment, but the truth is that things are so far gone that we can't just talk about it anymore and say, well, by 2050, we'll do something, because quite frankly, by 2050, the rate things are going, I'm close enough to the ocean. I may have to take up, you know, boating at the rate it's going, because it is rising all the time. So this stuff all seems to be tied in with the visits. And it's like you want to say to this consciousness, I know all this. What can I possibly do about it? And I guess what you can do about it is just tell people. I mean, I was at a meeting and I was with these people. This was one lady there who was 68 years old, a few years ago. And I was talking about people and their lack of knowledge of science and their knowledge of the cosmos. And I said, a good example is when I ask people what's the nearest star, they can never tell me. They may tell me it's Alpha Centauri if they know something about cosmology. And I'll say, well, that's wrong. And if that's wrong, yeah, it's wrong. because the sun is our nearest star. And that woman looked at me and said, "You mean our sun is a star?" And you could just see the light bulb go on. And she thanked me for it because all her life she never knew that.
Wow.
And that's the tip of the iceberg. So maybe if enough people who have these experiences, and even the ones that don't, communicate this, I don't know, maybe it'll make a difference. It's looking pretty bad right now, though. Yeah, I think that our best bet now is to build some big spaceships and get the heck out of here. Right. And don't make the mistake a second time.
So that is our show for the night, everybody. If you want to hear part two of the Steve Neal interview, which I'm sure you do because he's a very interesting guy, you'll have to wait till Saturday, August 28th. Man, that's a long time away, isn't it? But I'll make you guys a deal. If I get 10 reviews for my podcast, the Warped Reality Podcast, on either Apple Podcasts, or you could go to warpedrealitypodcast.com and leave me a review, I will post part two of the Steve Neal interview on Saturday, August 21st, a whole week earlier than I would have. So that is my deal with you guys. So thank you for listening to episode two of the Warped Reality Podcast. Again, please check out warpedrealitypodcast.com. If you have any paranormal experiences that you would like to share, 845-379-1331, and leave me a voicemail. It only goes up to 3 minutes, so if you run out of time, please call back and resume your call. You could do so anonymously if you choose. If you don't want me to play it, please let me know. Or if you don't want to leave me a voicemail at all, you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. Thank you to April Alder for the awesome segment. And thank you to you guys, the listeners, for checking out my show. Thank you for listening to the Warped Reality Podcast. I am Ghost Joe. I invite you to check out all of the previous episodes of the Warped Reality Podcast, as well as the Ghost Hacks Podcast episodes from Season 1. You can check out more Warped content at warpedrealitypodcast.com. Also, leave me a voicemail of your paranormal experiences at 845-379-1331 or email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. If you could, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or through our website. Have a good night, everybody, and don't forget to change your shorts.